We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
From Illinois Public Media, this is Focus on WILL Radio and online at will.illinois.edu. Good morning, I'm Celeste Quinn. The program is produced by Harriet Williamson. Our technical director is Jason Croft. On the program today, Computers and You, Peter Kimball is our guest. He is with the Fast 3 Consortium, Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Listeners, I welcome your questions about computers for Peter Kimball. Join us with a phone call or by email. Here are the phone numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Kimball, Peter Kimball, good to see you again. Welcome back. How are you?
I'm doing fine. It's nice to have the election season done with now for a few weeks.
And the weather is beautiful
today. It is wonderful out there.
Yeah, beautiful autumn day. Well, we have a couple of callers who are all ready and raring to go here. So let's go first to a listener in Savoy on line one. Hi.
Good morning. What is the stability of information stored on flash drives?
Generally, it's considered to be pretty good. Flash drives haven't, of course, been around for 10 or 15 or 20 years. But as long as they are well-treated, which means you don't allow them to, the contacts to get tarnished and dirty and broken, and as long as they are protected from static charges, so you wouldn't want to scoot across the floor in the middle of the winter and discharge your static buildup with the flash drive held in your hand, it should be pretty good. I don't know that there are any real statistics out on that yet, but especially if you want to have the data there, what would be in kind of an archival form, it would nonetheless be good to, if you've got a whole box full of flash drives that you're keeping digital photos and such on, for example, every year or two, reread and restore them on those drives to make sure that the charge on those flash drives doesn't cause any long-term problems.
The reason that I'm asking is that I was listening to flash drive MP3 files in my car, and had the MP3 player on the front seat, and it fell to the floor, and all of the files on the flash drive were erased. Would that be a static problem?
No, that is more likely a problem. The thing that can happen to any kind of a storage device, whether it's a flash drive or a portable hard drive or even a cell phone that's being used for storage if it's plugged in, is if it is interrupted in the process of recording or updating. So if the computer were storing something, or in some cases if it's reading and updating the last access date, and that's interrupted, such as by the flash drive being pulled out in the middle of a write operation, less often in the case of a read operation, that could cause the problem. It would not have been static electricity in this case. That was just
The flash drive wasn't plugged in at the moment. It was completely disconnected.
Should have had no effect then. So it just fell to the floor, and that was
It wasn't really a fall. The seat was only like a foot above a carpeted surface, and that's what was so surprising is how gentle it was, and yet it completely wiped it out.
And you have looked at that flash drive on other computer systems to make sure
it's...
I have no good answer as to why that would have happened, but physically, unless it's falling hard enough to break, I've dropped flash drives, kind of scattered some across the floor periodically with no difficulty.
Yeah. Well, you join a long list of people who have no explanation.
Sorry. I've actually never heard of that. I will take a look at it, but I've... It's not the kind of thing that you would expect to fail.
Yeah, right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Let's take another call. This is a listener in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Hi. I'm thinking about getting a Linux box. It's a computer. Is that what it is? Small. Is the upside and downside of such a thing, or?
Well, as you know, but some of the other listeners may not, Linux is another operating system. Windows is an operating system. The Macintosh System 10, the Macintosh software is an operating system. And Linux is an open source software system, which means that you're not paying Apple or Microsoft for it. It is a very powerful operating system, but it is not going to be as much of a plug-and-play operation as using a Macintosh or as using a Windows machine. So the downside would be there can be significant additional complexities in keeping it going, although there are a number of companies that package automatically installing Linux solutions. The other issue to be aware of is there is some software that will only run or is written to run on the Windows or the Macintosh platform, and those, unless there is a Linux version or unless you've got some kind of interpreter, those will not run on the Linux operating system. So your favorite specific software application may or may not be available in a Linux version. So those are the main downsides, a little bit more complexity and a little less flexibility in your software choice. One of the big upsides for people who get into it is they feel much more empowered. They are more in control, and once they get over the little learning curve of how to deal with it, there's a lot more flexibility.
Now, in Apple and them, do they use is it a Linux that that they use in terms of the computers at all or not?
Underneath the pretty Macintosh user interface, the Mac OS X is running Unix, which is kind of the original version of the software from which Linux was a kind of a shareware open source version. So yes, there's a lot of similarities between the underlying Unix kernel of code in a Macintosh and what you can get as Linux.
Okay, and finally, is there a in terms of using Wi-Fi, is there a security problem in terms with that or not?
There's always a concern any time you are opening up another avenue to get into your computer or into your system. So the simplest but perhaps too simplistic answer would be a system that is using Wi-Fi is going to be inherently somewhat less secure than one that does not. Having said that, if the Wi-Fi is properly implemented, which means you put in, you make sure that you have enabled the more recent security encryption settings, which any current Wi-Fi wireless router will certainly include in its software, there's really not too much difficulty in maintaining a secure environment.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call this morning. And we have an email question that's come in. Peter, could you recommend a laptop computer for my two daughters, one each, so cost is an issue. One daughter is 7, the other 10 years old. They mainly play games on the internet. My wife and I would also use these computers.
Well, that is a wide open question. The first decision that would have to be made, although it may well be made since the economy is one of the questions, would be do you go in the Macintosh or the Windows direction? There really aren't any inexpensive Macintosh laptops compared to what's available on the Windows platform, where you can get decently performing machines for well under $500. I would look at several things, and I don't really want to list a particular brand name without doing some research, but a lot of the major companies do have excellent machines and have laptops priced at the at sort of the entry-level point, so that would include Dell and HP and the others. Look for a machine that, though it will not be that expensive to start with, you don't perhaps want to go at the very low end, because it should remain useful for at least a few years as the requirements for software and the expectations that you have of the machine start to become more sophisticated. You'd want to look for a machine that, as I said, is probably going to be running Windows. You may not want to get one of the very low-end netbooks. They are the cheapest, but they are more limited. Those are kind of like the junior-size laptops. You would want to make sure that it has adequate storage, such as an internal hard drive. That would be the cheapest option, and those are fairly affordable now. So don't short yourself in terms of getting a machine that you'll outgrow. Having said that, get enough memory. You'll probably want to make sure that it's got decent wireless capabilities, which almost all laptops do, so that they can use it to do whatever you allow them to do on the internet from wherever they may be. I would just look for the more major companies. They generally have a better reliability record, and also you can do a number of reviews online. If you've picked out two or three that seem to be reasonable, you can then do a search and see what kind of customer response. You could also get a start by going to any of the big box stores, Best Buy and all the others, and see what they have. And then don't plan on buying one right then. Go home and research those machines and see what the general response is by others who own them.
Okay, I hope that helps. And let's take another telephone call. A listener in Champaign, Urbana, line 3. Good morning.
Hi. Discuss proxies, VPN. Are your passwords and emails safe over them? And pretty good privacy if there's a list of 100 people. How do you get started using it? I mean, like, does one person decide, and how do you apply it? Okay.
Well, it sounded like there were a couple of questions there. Now, I have not ever felt the need to use Pretty Good Privacy, or PGP. That is a public key encryption system in which you can encode your email in such a way that the recipient can decode it using what's called a public key. It's all based on giant prime numbers that computers can decode if they know what that number is, but it's almost impossible for a computer to crack into it. And that way, the recipient of the email or whoever is looking at that communication can be assured that it's really from you if their public key opens it and makes it readable. The same kind of encryption is done, but not with a key that you have to publish, with a lot of the secure websites. So when you're browsing and you have the little padlock icon or the little lock, or the web address starts with HTTPS, with the S meaning secure. And the same kind of encryption, which is basically without the resources of the National Security Agency, relatively uncrackable, would be true for using what's called a VPN. That stands for Virtual Private Network. And basically, by setting one of those up, which a lot of home routers, wireless access points can supply, and which the university makes available for its faculty, staff, and students. Basically, it sets up a connection over the public internet over which all traffic is encrypted and very sophisticated, in a very sophisticated way encrypted. And you're acting as sending this information almost as if you've built yourself a little tunnel, thus the virtual private network, and sometimes referred to as tunneling, to send the information through. Now, how you would get started, if you wanted to go the PGP route, basically, I have not done that, so you would need to go to one of the PGP sites. There'll be a number of them listed if you do a search, and you can then establish and apply for your own private key. And the other details, I've just never dealt with it, because when I'm traveling on the road, what I will do is I'll set up a virtual private network, and I know that everything I type and everything I send, whether it's on a secure website or not, is being encrypted. If I'm on a secure website, it's being doubly encrypted. So I don't know if that's going to help the caller or not. But for PGP, I It's a lot of people use it. I haven't bothered to. I haven't felt the need. It is very secure. And how to get started, you just have to look up.
Okay. Let's take another call. This is a listener in Sycamore. Line 4, hi.
Yeah, good morning. I'm interested in hearing your comments about solid-state hard drives. A computer I'm looking at has the option of having them installed instead of a normal mechanical rotating hard drive. And it seems to me that this is the wave of the future. And eventually, when this technology has become more widespread, there will be no more rotating disk hard drives. There will only be solid-state hard drives. So I'm interested to hear what you think of them at their current state.
I agree. They are certainly the wave of the future. They are very reliable. They are 10 to 100 times faster because they have no mechanical moving parts. The only downside these days is that per megabyte or per gigabyte of storage, they are considerably more expensive than rotating disk hard drives. That price will eventually start coming down, but a laptop, for example, that has solid-state storage in it will start up much more quickly, will store and retrieve data much more quickly, and will cost a bit more than the computer with the equivalent amount of rotating hard drive space. And if you needed lots and lots of hard drive space, such as hundreds or even thousands of gigabytes, a terabyte or so, that's still pretty unaffordable in terms of solid state. There was a well-renowned science and science fiction writer, Arthur C. Clarke, who, among other things, proposed the idea of geosynchronous satellites. But one of his principles in one of his books was that no machine may have any moving parts. And that's the direction, of course, that we're moving with the solid state memory.
Very good. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Highly recommended, in other words.
Okay. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And this is Focus on WILL AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Gwynn. We're talking about computers this morning with Peter Kimball. He's with the Fast 3 Consortium, Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Listeners, you can join us this morning with a phone call or by email. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. Will, and our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. No one waiting on the phone at the moment, but we do have another email question.
All right.
I have Vista on my laptop, and I am not impressed. No particular reason. I like and have XP on another computer and Windows 7 on another. I haven't done a lot of research about 7, but it does seem to be widely compatible. I'm happy with it so far. The question is, I'd like to replace Vista, and I'm leaning toward XP for familiarity and wide compatibility, forgive me. But how long do you think new software will be made to have XP compatibility? I don't want to spend money on it only to find I have to upgrade in the not-too-distant future.
Microsoft has announced the end of life of Windows XP, I believe, early in 2013. They've already done the end of life announcement for the Service Pack 1 and Service Pack 2 versions of XP. So and at that point, there will be no further security enhancements and no further support available. And already there are some applications that are being written that simply will not run. There's no point in having them run on XP. So the trend the writer feared has already begun. I would recommend that he consider moving to Windows 7. Vista definitely has a number of issues. Microsoft just passed its one-year anniversary of shipping Windows 7 with an incredibly large number out there. Something like 60 or 70% of all new consumer PCs now have Windows 7 on it, and I think 250, 260 million copies out there. And everybody who uses it says this is what Vista should have been. So I would, even though you may be more comfortable with XP, it does have a limited life, and I would recommend thinking strongly about taking your Vista system and taking it up to Windows 7 rather than backwards to XP.
Okay, let's take another phone call. This is a listener on line one in Philo. Hi.
Hi. Rich, I had a question about wanted to replace my very old computer. It's a laptop, but it's over 10 pounds, and it's really old, but it works. I wondered, and I hope you hadn't talked about this, not a recommendation so much as I was thinking of a netbook, and then you convinced me otherwise. For generally, how much hard drive for my own how much RAM and how many ports would you suggest for a computer that's gonna that I want to last for at least a couple of years? That's gonna be a laptop, you know. And how many? I guess you need different ports for, you know, if I ever get an iPad, or by then it'll probably be something else that's coming up the pike.
Well, yes, I can. Let me address a couple of those things. Let me back up in case I was a little bit too harsh on netbooks. I would not recommend a netbook necessarily as somebody's only laptop, but if you were doing a lot of flying, a netbook is much more convenient if you're crowded into an airplane seat than a laptop would be. However, as a primary machine, I would think that most people would not be entirely satisfied with it. In terms of what the hard drive capability should have, you should, you've got a whole range of directions you can go. At a minimum, the amount of RAM that you should have installed in it, or that it should come with, is 2 gigabytes. You could go to more if you are doing a lot of video and such and dealing with a lot of high-end photograph manipulation.
Okay.
But 2 gigabytes at a minimum. For the hard drive, they're relatively cheap these days. You could get, without paying much of a premium, maybe a 160-gigabyte or a 320-gigabyte hard drive, which should be more than you would ever need. In terms of the ports, generally the most common way of connecting to them these days is with what's called a universal serial bus or USB port.
Right.
Two or three of those would probably be fine, but USB, if you are having this thing and using it at home, even if you only had one or two ports, there are USB port expanders that you could plug into it. One thing you might look at, it's starting to appear on more and more laptops, and eventually within the next year or so will be on all of them. USB has gone through a number of versions. There was USB 1 and then USB 2 is the most common now. And now USB 3 specification, those ports are starting to appear. The advantage of it is that the transfer back and forth over that connection is much faster than the current standard of USB 2. So if you had the option, and relatively new laptops will offer this, USB 3 would be nice but not essential.
And faster in terms of internet connection, or faster just in terms of processing?
Faster in terms, for example, if you had a connection to an external hard drive.
Okay.
You wouldn't really notice it being any faster in terms of the internet connection, which is probably not going to go through your USB port anyway. Probably with a laptop, it would be connected wirelessly. The bottleneck there is simply your connection speed. The USB port, even 2.0, even the 1.0, is going to be faster than most people's internet connections. But
okay.
It's for high-volume information, such as moving things to an external hard drive.
Yes.
Or from a camera, if you have a whole bunch of things that you're downloading from a camera. If it's on USB 1, it might take 3 minutes. If it's USB 2, it might take 25 seconds. USB 3, it might take 5 or 10 seconds.
Okay. And another question, if I may. I have my old one has a CD port, you know, a DVD port. I mean,
an optical drive, sure.
Thank you. And it's, but I'm thinking, you know, most now, people, I think CDs seem like they're going, I might still listen to them, but I'm not going to be watching many movies, and I guess you can download them from the internet, so you don't do most of them come with an optical port?
Oh, the smaller ones tend not to, and most of Apple's new machines don't have it because it adds bulk and size. Yes, you can download movies from the Internet, but if you have a pretty good library of CDs and or DVDs, that might be more of a impetus to have a CD or DVD drive. It's not essential to have it built in, although it will draw a little bit more on your laptop's battery. There are external CD and DVD drives that are pretty compact that would plug in via a USB port.
Okay.
So that route would be a possibility as well.
Right. And if I had time for a third, it's just I have a satellite at home so that I can have fast internet. And I'm looking at Wi-Fi, so I guess it's Wi-Fi where you have a little card that you put in or a little something that you stick in so that you can have internet all around.
Yes. Well, there are two components. One is the laptop or whatever computer you want to have connected via Wi-Fi needs to have either a separate card, a network interface card, or a NIC card, it's sometimes called. But most new laptops are going to have Wi-Fi built into them. But
okay.
You also need what is called a wireless access point. That's what's actually doing the transmitting of the Wi-Fi signal. And basically, wherever your signal is coming in, the internet signal from the satellite arrangement you have now, instead of plugging that into a computer, you plug that into the wireless access point, which can then transmit it out to any machine that has a wireless card.
Okay. And that requires a subscription to a service, correct?
Well, you already have the subscription to the service, I presume, with the satellite internet service.
Well, yeah, I suppose it's HughesNet. I don't know that. It works in my house.
Right.
But they would just be the same provider.
Well, currently, does the signal come into some kind of a box that that HughesNet provides for you?
Right. Yeah.
And so from that box, you then plug that your computer into that box.
Yes.
So now instead of plugging your computer into the box, you plug in a wireless access point, and most internet service providers, I can't tell you about yours particularly,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
They don't particularly care whether you have a single PC plugged into their box or a device, a wireless access point or a wireless router, it's sometimes called. It looks like a computer to the internet service provider's box. But instead of being just a single computer, it actually can distribute the signal to whomever you may wish, whatever other laptops you may have.
Okay, because we have a router now that I can use. I can use wireless, but I can't use it outside, by a couple hundred feet from my house.
Well, depending on the wireless that you get, there may well be some limits. Some wireless types of, depending on what walls you've got and the lay of the land, you may be limited to a few hundred feet.
Okay. So my provider I could call and see.
Yes. Some providers used to say, if you're going to plug in one of these devices and use multiple machines, we're going to have to charge you more. But most providers, at least the telephone company with DSL lines and the cable company with cable modems, no longer make that distinction.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
Okay, good luck to you.
And here is an email question, Peter. I think I heard somewhere that there are programs that will help you find duplicates, both text and pictures, on your computer. Is that true? And are any of them free? I run Vista.
Well, I suspect because the general answer is you can find almost anything, any sort of an application. I'm not familiar with one. I assume that what the correspondent was asking was they've got a whole bunch of images and text, and they think they've probably duplicated a number of them. There are a number of programs that will act as cataloging programs that will scan your entire hard drive and look for every image and give you some master list. I'm unaware of any that specifically have a look for duplicates, but if the file names are duplicates, which is about the only good way you'd have to tell if the images were the same, then those kinds of file managing programs, of which there are many, would be able, you'd see them, both of them listed one after the other. Of course, that's not going to work if you have the same image that you happen to store for whatever reason with two different names, because then you'd have to go into the image analysis, and that's a whole other issue. So unfortunately, I can't give you any particular names of software, but there are certainly a lot of file management and image management software packages out there that are either free or that are shareware. You try it. If you like it, send a developer $10 or $15 so they can continue to develop.
Okay, and let's take another call now. Next, we're going to go to Montgomery, line 4. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I got a couple questions for you. One is, I have Skype. I've got that, you know, the video thing.
Yes.
And I got it from Radio Shack, and it does have a tendency to cut out. Now, when the other person is talking to me at the other end, it seems like they cut out, but I'm not cutting out to them. And I have basically the same system they do because I bought it from them. Is there... Do you recommend, and now I bought it from Radio Shack a while back, so I want to say it's probably been 3 or 4 years. Do they have a better version of that? Do, for instance, the laptops, are they better with the camera than, say, the PCs or what? Because I'm looking at PCs versus, you know, the laptop right now. I want to get away from the big ones and basically have something that's portable. Do you recommend anything, or?
Well, when you say it's dropping out, the audio or just the images dropping out for a while, or both?
No, it's the audio. The images are fine.
Okay.
It's just when you're. It seems like when you're talking, and or when they're talking on their end, they can hear us fine, but we can't hear them.
So it's kind of like this a little bit.
You're like talk, you know.
Yes.
A cell phone.
Okay. There are a couple of things. It's mostly that is probably due to a combination of network efficiency and possibly some settings that might be adjustable on the in the software itself. In order to economize on the amount of information that's being sent, there are basically automatic volume. It's like an automatic volume control. When it senses that nothing is being said, it essentially stops sending things. So it could well be that on the other person's system, they are either speaking too softly or the software is set so that when they're fairly soft like this, the system says, I don't think they're talking, so I'm just going to cut that out until they speak more loudly. So that would be the first thing that I would check. That's the most common reason. I don't believe if it's working at all and if it works regularly that there would be a difficulty with the actual hardware. That's always possible. Have the person you're corresponding with verbally, you know, using Skype, you might have them speak and intentionally speak louder and clearer without too many pauses in between and see if that helps alleviate the problem. And if so, it's probably a software setting where it thinks that they've stopped talking when they're actually not talking as loudly.
Is there anything you can recommend as far as laptops? Because I'm actually looking at going to just a laptop. This thing I've got now is like 8, 9 years old.
Sure.
And I think it's limited as far as RAM and, you know, all that kind of things. And
almost any laptop, any reasonably priced laptop from a few hundred bucks on up certainly has the capability. They almost all now have built-in webcams, built-in microphones. The speakers may be a little tinny, but you can always plug in something external to those. Just about any laptop you can buy other than the very bottom end should do just fine.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Thanks.
You're very welcome. Next, we take a call from a listener in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. You've covered part of this topic before. I'm not too worried about the security between my desktop computer and my laptop here at home because it's a secure network. But occasionally I have to go to the library and use it. And use some of their equipment as well for projection. And I'm wondering, would VPM give me added protection, or don't you think it's necessary?
So you are taking your laptop with you
My laptop. Mm-hmm.
And you have access to a VPN, so my guess is perhaps you're affiliated with the university?
Yes. Actually, there are a couple of freeware ones, but I wasn't aware of the university until you mentioned it before. Maybe I should look into that.
There are a couple of options there. Mostly it's so that university faculty, staff, and students can log into university or other resources when they're on the road.
Mm-hmm.
If the library that you are connecting with is one, for example, on campus, the wireless security that the university has arranged for their networks is pretty good, and I wouldn't be too concerned about doing things on campus. If you're going elsewhere, other libraries, coffee shops, the general advice would be certainly it is good to it's more secure if you have access to a VPN, because then even if what you are typing is intercepted, as it could possibly be, because a lot of public sites do not encrypt their wireless networks so that people can easily log onto them, which means anybody else within range could look at the traffic. That's not so much a problem if you are at a secure website, but for other sorts of things, it could be a issue in terms of your information being revealed.
Well, the library here in town, at least the Champaign one, is not secure.
Yes, and they can't really secure it, because then they'd have to be dealing with everybody, you know, logging on with the particular passwords. So
true.
A VPN connection, which would make everything encrypted from your machine onto wherever it's to the VPN endpoint at the other end from which it goes out onto the internet, would certainly be very secure. I don't know how necessary it is. I try to make it a point whenever I'm out at some public access point, even though I will use a VPN, I will avoid going to any really sensitive sites like financial or credit card sites,
mm-hmm.
where I have to type passwords and that sort of thing. The other thing, and I don't want to instill any paranoia, but I'll mention this.
Oh, probably, I'm paranoid anyway.
Okay, well... Yes, as the old joke goes, how many paranoics does it take to change a light bulb? Who wants to know? but the issue that occasionally has happened more in large cities are kind of rogue hotspots. You'll be in a coffee shop and you'll connect wirelessly, and if you don't pay too much attention to the wireless network, you might discover that there's the coffee shop, whatever the name of their wireless is, and somebody in there could have set up their own wireless access point, and if you accidentally get onto theirs, you're sending everything through their machine. So if I'm, for example, in let's say Espresso Royale, I would want to look for an Espresso Royale ID for the network and not something that's, Coffee 2 or Rip You Off 1 or something, although
mm-hmm.
they obviously wouldn't give you that sort of a name.
No.
So just pay attention to which network you're connecting to.
Would PGP work?
PGP, pretty good privacy?
Yes.
Or were you talking about P2P, point-to-point protocol?
I was talking
too many
about
acronyms.
Pretty good privacy.
Okay. Yes, it would. There's a little bit more setup in there, and you wouldn't really need to do that if you have, if you're connected through a VPN, that sort of makes the need to have the PGP a little bit redundant. Both of them are technologies that can encrypt the traffic between your machine and wherever it's going.
Occasionally, I do have to use the computer at either a hotel or a coffee shop. So that would probably be more important than the library. But I understand there's some snoopware available now that makes it very easy to intercept messages.
Well, and there has been for a long time. In fact, some of it has been simply out there as diagnostic software that network technicians need to see what kind of traffic is going on. But if your traffic is encrypted, either using PGP or simplest, as if you've got access to a VPN, then there's no way that they'll be able to see what's inside those encrypted packets without spending years on trying to crack the code.
Well, thank you.
You're quite welcome.
We've spent a lot of time on this, but it's really very helpful for me.
Good.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for the call this morning. This is Focus on WILL AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. My name is Celeste Quinn. We're talking about computers in this hour of the program today. Peter Kimball is our guest. He's with the Fast 3 Consortium, Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois. If you've got a question about computers, give us a call or drop us an email. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. So no one waiting at the moment. Been a very busy morning for you, Peter.
That's always good, I see a couple calls coming in. Let me just, while they're being answered, a bit of news that just came across the wire yesterday is that Apple is apparently starting to ease its position on the availability of Flash on its iPhones and iPads and such. Not that you'll be able to get Flash files directly. Steve Jobs had this big, I think it would be fair to call it a position and or a diatribe, but that Flash was just not reliable. It sucked power and it caused more errors than anything else. But for a number of reasons, they have now softened that stance, and it's possible to have what are called pre-compiled Flash applications out. That doesn't mean you're going to be able to use your iPad right away and go off and visit all of these sites, but they're responding to customer demand, to competition from things like the Android, and to assumed government investigations. So there's light at the end of the tunnel, perhaps, for iPad, iPhone, and iPod users.
Let's take another call now. This is a listener in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Hi there. I'm thinking about setting up a home server, and I don't have any experience with running Linux, but I understand that that would be the way to go. For a complete newbie hack like me, what kind of distribution do you think would be good, or like hardware setup, so that I don't completely get in over my head?
Well, the hardware setup, almost any machine that you would get these days, and even almost any machine you bought in the last 5 or 10 years, would be adequate to run a server, a machine running the Linux operating system. What are you planning on having this machine do? Is it going to be like a web server? Is it going to be receiving your email, or do you know what kind of, or is that a question that you haven't yet addressed?
Well, initially what I'd want to set it up as is a file server.
Okay.
Just for in my house. Then if I can figure out how to do it without completely compromising security, I'd like to get a VPN set up so I could access it remotely, and eventually start using it as a hub to build a smart house so I can put sensors in my house and things like that.
Which is actually going to be something that a lot of people have done with Linux. As you said, you need some kind of a distribution, which is basically the set of packages that includes Linux and various tools and utilities to manage and configure it. There are several out there, a lot of people, and they're not... they're not licensed in the same way that the Macintosh or the Windows operating systems are, but I know a lot of people like the Red Hat Linux distribution. There are several others out there, and many of those more sophisticated user, end-user friendly versions will help talk you through the process of getting things set up. The initial goal that you have of setting up as a file server is really perhaps one of the simplest, because there's really not much special software necessary. You could use, for example, a Windows or a Macintosh as a file server with doing almost nothing. Likewise, with the case of Linux, once you have it up and running. Security, you do need to be aware, just as the Windows, as Microsoft releases security patches regularly, and just as Apple releases security patches for the Macintosh, so does the various companies that make the Linux distribution. So you'd have to stay on top of that. Other than that, there's no real security issue.
Okay, so is there any distribution that's better known for security or any of that?
You know, there may be. If so, I'm not aware of it. Any of the major distributions, and the only one that's coming to mind at the moment is the one I mentioned before, the Red Hat, but there are several, and I would simply go to perhaps one of the PC Magazine or CNET sites, or perhaps just a generic Google search, and take a look at search terms such as Linux distribution reviews. And see what you get, and there'll be some kind of technical articles, and there'll also be some that are going to be more end-user oriented, saying, well, here's the advantages of Red Hat versus this versus that.
Great. Thanks very much.
Uh-huh.
You're welcome. And next we go to a listener on a cell phone, line 3. Good morning.
Good morning. First, I'd like to know what a VPN is. It's difficult to understand acronyms. Second, I'd like to know, I just switched to the AT&T Internet, high-speed Internet, and I wondered if you know what are the risks in terms of security and privacy with that. Thank you.
Well, VPN is an acronym. It stands for Virtual Private Network, and it is basically a way of setting a secure connection that's thoroughly encrypted between two endpoints, such as your machine and whatever the location is at which that VPN is implemented. For University of Illinois users, for example, if they are traveling, if they have the appropriate software, which is freely available on their particular computer system and have it set up, the computer is thinking that I'm not connecting through a standard internet connection. I'm connecting through this virtual private network. And to do so, you have to authenticate yourself by typing a name and a password so that the machine at the university end says, okay, I recognize you are a user. We're going to send all the traffic between here and your computer out wherever you're using it in the secured fashion. And once it gets here, I'll send it off to whatever web servers or whatever other things you're doing, whatever kind of surfing you're doing or whatever sort of resources. So it is a private, encrypted pathway from one point to another on the internet that involves a little bit of software at each end. In terms of the AT&T high-speed internet, the digital subscriber lines, no matter what kind of connection you want, you do definitely want to have virus protection, and you would like to have what's called a firewall. That's software that prevents unwanted intrusions from coming in. Windows, for example, has a built-in firewall that is better than none at all, and there are a number of companies, security suite companies, that have firewalls that can get much more aggressive at filtering things out. But the basic fact that you've gone to a DSL line is relatively secure because AT&T does the way that DSL communications are distributed is not quite the same as with a cable modem. All the traffic isn't available on that line. People can snoop a little bit if they really work at it, but with a good firewall and most importantly, very good virus protection that you keep up to date, I don't think you have any more and probably. Literally, probably no more security issues than you would with any other way of getting to the internet.
Okay. Next, we go to Aurora, line 4. Hi.
Hi. Well, I'm thankful for a caller on line 3 there for asking what VPN was, because that was one of my questions.
Oh. Okay.
Now, as I get older, I like to go out and do some more traveling stuff, but I still want to keep up on what my stocks and commodities are doing. Is there any way, I'm not connected with the university, so that VPN wouldn't do me any good? But is there any way that I could take and protect myself out there if I were on a different, a Wi-Fi or something like that?
Using your own computer that you're taking with you?
Yes, a laptop, huh?
All right. There are probably, I don't want to minimize or say that the risks are zero, but if you are certain when you log on that you're logging on to a legitimate Wi-Fi site and not somebody's rogue site that they've set up, which happens very rarely and mostly is in larger cities. So you're looking and your laptop is saying, I would like to connect, here's all of these various Wi-Fi networks I connect to. Don't just pick the first one on the list. Make sure that it's the one that seems to belong to the coffee shop. Ask the coffee shop or the library if it's a question. And then, since nearly any site that you are going to visit for the stocks and such, where you have to identify yourself, will be a secure site, you'll have the little padlock icon. The address will be HTTPS for secure. That tells you that that web traffic is being encrypted and at a fairly high level so that you don't have to worry over much about people interceding and getting that information. I don't know of any financial or credit card site that does not secure the connection. It would just be absolutely inappropriate. And the big advantage is you're using your machine so that you know that nobody's installed any sneaky key monitoring software on it. So VPN would be an extra layer of security, but one that's probably not necessary as long as you're sure that you're connecting to a legitimate Wi-Fi hotspot and that you're connecting with a secure connection and that your virus protection is up to date.
Okay. Once in a while in the mail, I'll get something. There's an internet company, and it escapes me right now. But, there's several of them, of course, that you can get it, get your own off of, I guess it comes from a satellite. And you can get it probably almost anywhere in the United States. Is that pretty secure?
It's relatively secure. Again, as one caller that was online a little bit earlier was using a satellite sort of connection. Satellite access is what people need to pretty much resort to if they don't have access, so they're not in an urban area where they can get cable or digital subscriber telephone lines. It is relatively secure, but again, with the proviso that make sure you have firewall and antivirus software, and it's probably about as good as anything else in terms of security.
Okay. And one more quick thing. On a computer, how do you delete history? I forgot. How would you do that?
Which browser? It depends on which browser you're using.
Oh, okay.
If you're using Internet Explorer, for example, you can go up to the Tools menu, and I don't recall, because I don't have an Internet Explorer machine right here in front of me, Tools, and there's a probably in the first tab that comes up, you can delete the browser history. You could do a search for delete browser history. It's a little bit different in Firefox. It's a little bit different in Safari. But the other thing you can do, if you wish, and you're going to be traveling, is you can set those programs so they automatically delete the history after one day.
Oh, okay.
It doesn't keep, by default, I think most of them will keep the history around for about 3 weeks or so.
That's correct.
You can also set them so that they never remember passwords, which is probably a good idea for anything other than a computer that's always in your house.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I won't take any more of your time.
Okay. You're quite welcome.
That's good because we don't have any more time. We're out of time.
It has flown past.
It has flown past. Very busy morning today for Peter Kimball. We will talk once again about computers next month. December 2nd, we talk about computers in the second hour of Focus on the first Thursday of the month, and next month that will be December 2nd. Peter Kimball, thank you so much.
Oh, it was a lot of fun. It always is.